Hi, I'm Libby.
And I'm Riley, and welcome to On the Come Up.
What's up, Libby?
Hey.
You know what I always think about?
What do you always think about?
Marshall Erickson from How I Met Your Mother.
Oh, yeah. And our favorite guy.
Let me tell you why. I, once a day at least, look at someone and say, lawyered. And I think it is strictly because of him,
yeah,
right? Like,
yes.
Obviously, it's got to be.
Everything I know about lawyers is from Marshall Erickson.
Exactly. But lucky for us, we have a guest today who's going to get to teach us a little bit more about the law community,
yes,
in our area. And that is Nick Bartlett. Hi, Nick.
Hi, guys.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Are you excited to be here?
I am. I hope I don't offend you. I actually didn't really watch How I Met Your Mother, so I'm so
That's
sorry.
Okay. That's
I didn't
okay.
really yeah, understand the reference.
It's not a prereq, but...
It's all right. You know, you can make up for it in some of your good answers to these questions.
Well,
all right?
I hope so.
So first, we just want to get to know a little bit about your background, where you were born and raised, and then just talk a little bit about your life pre-undergrad.
Yeah, I born and raised Toledo. I grew up specifically in Sylvania. I went to Northview for high school.
Let's go Wildcats.
Yeah. Well, I was on the football team, so, you know, we weren't really that good. So not a whole lot of cheering throughout my time
there. Fair. Very fair.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really, honestly, looking back on my high school experience and growing up, I didn't really do a whole lot, socially especially. I've definitely kind of grown into myself as I got, like, much older.
That's fair.
But if you knew me back then, I was such a weird, like, reserved, not very talkative. So, I mean, I didn't really have a ton going on in high school until undergrad.
And that bodes perfectly for you being a lawyer, I guess.
Yeah, nothing.
Love to talk, love to be out there.
Yeah, school. I hated reading, I hated writing, and I hated public speaking. And I picked the worst career for my high school self.
There you go.
Exactly. Well, and so, you know, you didn't initially start out in law. You started out with sports management, right, at Cleveland State. So talk a little bit about why you entered that field and then kind of what you learned through that degree and other leadership skills. You know, you were involved with the Leadership Institute, mentoring in the fraternity. Talk a little bit about your Cleveland State undergrad experience.
Who told you all of this?
I'm just a really good stalker. Rawr.
Okay. Gosh, I didn't have notes to take down everything you said, so you might have to remind me as I go on. But I kind of had my interest picked for law school and being a lawyer toward the end of high school. Mm-hmm. I was really into Boston Legal. That was my show.
Mm.
And everybody I had reached out to and asked, they really said, you know, your undergrad major doesn't really matter. So thinking of that, I wanted to pick something that I was interested in and could also fall back on in the event law school didn't really pan out. And
right.
I'm really into sports. I like football the most, but, you know, I watch basketball, volleyball. I'm trying to get into, you know, the pickleball now with the Toledo Pickle coming in. So that's going to be fun. I went to it's a really obscure story with how I managed to find myself at Cleveland State. My sister was, she went to, for her first year of undergrad, the New Jersey Institute of Technology. I promise this will link itself. It's going off on a wild tangent that makes no sense. So long story short, didn't really work out over there. She was playing volleyball, and the summer after she left the school, she had to make her way over to New Jersey to pick up some of her stuff. And she took a Greyhound. Well, the like initial link from the Toledo Greyhound didn't show up. So we had to drive her at like 11 p.m. on a random like weekday to Cleveland, which was the next stop for the Greyhound.
Right.
And I just remember getting into Cleveland. I mean, it was dark and I couldn't really see a whole lot, but outside the car window, I was just looking and was like, oh, there's a school like in downtown Cleveland. Like, just seems so like cool to me. And I just never forgot about it by the time that I was actually looking for colleges. So I ended up going there.
Interesting.
I love that.
Yeah, that's such a nice story. So then you ended up studying law at UT. So talk about how you transitioned, you know, back to Toledo. What brought you back here?
Yeah. And you know, part of one of the reasons, well, one of the reasons I went to Cleveland, I kind of wanted to go away from home and kind of get a fresh start with just meeting new people and doing different things. That came at a price,
mm-hmm.
And I definitely didn't have a full scholarship. And fortunately, I was lucky enough to get that at Toledo for law school, mm-hmm. and I made the smart decision to take that.
Yeah, right.
And also commute from just living at home. So I moved back in with my mom, saved a bunch of money. Yeah. But I mean, I did also attend a very fine institution and got a pretty great legal education while I was at it.
Yeah, that worked out really great. So talk about then, were studying sports management. Like, what brought you then into fully going for law? And kind of what that transition was like.
You know, it wasn't too bad. I don't think there wasn't really a huge transition just from, you know, sports management specifically. But the way law school is run, mm-hmm. Like just in the classroom, is just wildly different from any other classroom experience I've ever had. So yeah. I definitely had a very come to grips, like harsh reality type of adjustment with law school. You know, undergrad, they had the books that you had to get. You know, I bought them because in my mind I was like, gosh, you know, what side do I err on? I felt that if I didn't, you know, rent the book or didn't have it, I was going to need it.
Right.
And I always rented it or bought it, and I didn't really end up needing it or reading it.
Mm-hmm.
Law school, I had to read every page of every book that I ever got. And some of the reading assignments, and we're talking like, especially in constitutional law, you're looking close to like 80 to 100 pages sometimes for reading assignments.
Yikes.
And I wasn't really much of a reader before that. So it definitely also was an adjustment in terms of like speed with reading, because I would spend hours with my head in a book, and especially con law, not really understanding what I was reading with some of these cases from like 1800 something. So.
No, for sure.
Right. You're like, how can I take this and apply it to now?
Right, exactly. And just the way they spoke, like the judges would write, is not how anybody speaks today. So it was just very difficult. And law school uses like the quote-unquote Socratic method. So you could be sitting in class and just be picked on. And that is one of the most anxious feelings, too, and just feeling like you're not prepared at any moment just to be called on out of the blue.
Sure. That is frightening. I would not love that method myself.
No, definitely not.
But I want to talk about, you know, for somebody who says that you don't like reading or writing, you were one of the editors at the UT Law Review, and you authored the work Honing In on Hardware, Data Security Concerns of Large Companies. So I want to talk about your interest in this topic and your process writing it, and maybe what some people might not know regarding data security.
Gosh, you really found all the stuff about me online. Mm-hmm.
I feel like we're doing Narnar, like...
Yeah, right.
Also, side note, I got a bunch of copies of those, so if anybody wants one, I just have them, like, collecting dust in my house right now.
Oh, I love that. I'll read it.
Yeah, so I had a great professor. His name is Eric Chafee. He actually ended up moving over to... He teaches over at Case Western now. But... He was the professor that sort of advised my law review note, and I kind of chose that topic because at the time, and you know, within the last few years, it seemed like data breaches were unfortunately a commonplace issue, point of conversation, and it seemed like everything was focused on, oh, somebody's remotely hacking in, you know, over the cloud or whatever exists or doesn't exist above us right now in the ether. And I just wanted to, part of that note was just saying, hey, don't forget about just securing the actual physical hardware itself.
Yeah.
Because with all that attention on the...
Metadata.
The metadata, exactly. All that stuff that's just floating out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just more just like a reminder, like, hey, let's still lock up your computers. And, you know, because it's like also a personal reminder. At work, I have a firm issued laptop,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I still have... You know, my own, you know, I got to keep in mind, you know, if I leave my desk or if I just go anywhere and work outside of the office, if I'm in a coffee shop, I should probably lock it or take it with me if I go to the bathroom, if I go do anything. So it's just like, it's just a reminder to take care of that kind of equipment.
Yeah, the flip side that you can control.
What you might not always think about, but you should.
Definitely. I love that.
So, you know, kind of transitioning out of law school, how did you get your current position now at Eastman & Smith, and how has that been for you?
Yeah, so, gosh, two summers during law school, I interned with the public defender for the city, mm-hmm. the criminal public defender, so doing criminal law. Found out that I did not like that. but one of the prosecutors that I had the opportunity to chat with, her husband is a partner at Eastman & Smith, where I work. So I had interviewed, that's kind of how I, you know, learned of the firm, and I had interviewed, they have like a summer associate program. Mm-hmm. So I interviewed for that, ended up actually interviewing with the prosecutor's husband. His name's Mark Sandretto. I don't know if we're like cool name dropping people, but anyway. And I ended up getting the position, was super excited about it. When I found out I got the summer associate position, that was like August of 2019. Mm-hmm. Not sure if you recall what happened shortly thereafter.
Oh, what? Do we have like a global pandemic or something?
So they actually ended up canceling the summer associate program.
Oh, no. Oh, boo.
I know. And I was like very sad and also freaking out because I didn't have a job for the summer.
Don't worry, guys. There's a happy ending.
Eventually, I kind of weaseled my way back in. I emailed Mark and I said, hey, I don't know if you remember me. I interviewed with you like a year ago. I don't know if you need help. I'm looking for a job still. And I was able to interview with he works in litigation. So I was able to work with interview with the litigation folks. And they hired me on as a clerk and eventually offered me full time employment after I took the bar.
We nice. Love that. Yeah. And that persistence is such a good lesson, I think, especially for people our age, just to kind of seize those opportunities rather than waiting for them to come to you, you know?
And that's definitely something I didn't really do a lot, even in undergrad. So I really kind of made it a point to myself to definitely, you know, be more persistent and, you know, be more proactive as I, you know, took into law school and like my career. So yeah,
we love that. Absolutely. We love it. So at Eastman and Smith, there you have kind of three different focuses, right? The business litigation, the eminent domain, and then professional liability practice. So please, in layman's terms, explain those for us.
Sure. So, and I guess I cleared with my office before I came on here. So I really, for my ethical responsibilities, I want to make sure to all the listeners out there, nothing I say is to be construed as legal advice. if you have your own issues, please consult an attorney. You can talk to me. You can talk to anybody in the area. I can also refer you if I don't handle whatever dispute that you currently have. But I want to make that clear from the get-go. Otherwise, I will get in trouble.
So true.
So...
lawyered.
Literally lawyered.
So, yeah, in layman's terms, I mean, really, in reality, I'm in my third to fourth year of practicing. I do whatever the partners tell me to do. Mm-hmm. It's more than just those three areas, but that's like my main focus, a majority of my work. Business litigation, just any disputes involving businesses. Sometimes there's, you know, contracts between businesses. One party thinks the other party breached the contract. Mm. You know, somebody tries to sell you, somebody sells, you know, 1,000 shirts and maybe only get 500. So right. There's like, it's not as simple as that always. eminent domain is a little bit more interesting. It's a little more niche. That's where like the state or the federal government or whatever tries to actually like take your property.
Oh.
And there's like a subset of my office. We represent landowners.
Cool.
In actions against the state. And if there's ever an area where I think eminent domain would be particularly useful, it's widening that portion of Secor Road between Bancroft and Central.
Speak on it.
Need eminent domain. Somebody get in there, like Ohio Department of Transportation. Somebody needs to widen that, please.
Sounds like a job for a lawyer to organize. Someone who understands eminent domain.
I'm not sure.
And then that professional liability practice as well. What does that kind of look like?
Yeah, so that's your medical malpractice and your legal malpractice. So our office represents both physicians and then other attorneys.
So you're doing a little bit of everything.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And obviously, we don't want you to break any confidentiality here. So we're trying to be very, you know, diplomatic in how we ask some of these questions. But
right, but I am curious, what is the most challenging case you've worked on?
Oh, I will probably say there's been a very interesting one that I kind of came in on the first appeal. It's related to real property. It's mm-hmm. called, it has to do with something called adverse possession. Gosh, I'm sorry. I'm going to get real technical. So this doesn't come up a ton, but imagine your next door neighbor fences in their property, what they think is their property.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, the fence has gone over into your property.
Mm.
In Ohio, at least, sometimes in other states, there's a different time frame. In Ohio, after 21 years, your neighbor can then file an action with the court and say, hey, this is my property now.
Oh.
Yes.
After that long?
Yeah. And so that's like kind of the point is we expect landowners to kind of monitor their property and be aware of the property lines. Like that's the general public policy.
Right.
And you give the owner a pretty big chunk of time, at least in Ohio, to actually do something about it.
Right. Mm,
okay. So we're doing one. We have one right now. Our client lost at the trial court level. So our client was the original property owner.
Mm-hmm.
The other party sued for adverse possession for our client's property.
Mm-hmm.
So lost at the trial court level. I went and actually did the oral argument on appeal, which was very exciting. It's actually on YouTube, too. Did you find that in your background?
No, I didn't. But man, so, I should have looked you up on YouTube.
If you look up, it's the 9th District Court of Appeals. And there is a YouTube recorded oral argument that I did. And I wasn't particularly loud. So I'm not a loud speaker. And I thought I was trying to project. But looking at it after the fact, I was just trying to hold my phone speaker up and trying to like really, really listen to what I was saying. But on the other side, I was like, thank God I can't hear myself. I'm dealing with that right now with these headphones.
I'm impressed. Did not know that we had a famous lawyer in our studio today.
Okay, calm down.
How many views does it have on YouTube?
Probably like 5.
About to be 6 when we're done.
But so lost that and we appealed. And the way appeals work, you get one as of right. So you have the ability to appeal after a judgment no matter what. And the next court up will hear it. After that, if you want to appeal to the Ohio Supreme Court, it's within their discretion whether or not to actually take your appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to raise, I might slightly butcher the words, you have to raise a matter of great or general public concern for the Ohio Supreme Court to take an appeal. So the issue in this case is Ohio has delineated kind of categories of uses that are sufficient to put a landowner on notice that their property is being taken by adverse possession.
Mm-hmm.
One of those is explicitly not like lawn maintenance. So your neighbor can't mow like 5 feet into your lawn for 21 years and then think that they're entitled to your property. So, and that's key because the first 2 years, that's what the adverse possessor did. And that's important because then, you know, 19 years later,
there you go.
They did a little bit more, but our issue is you didn't do enough for a long enough period of time, as vague and general as that sounds.
Understood.
So the Ohio Supreme Court accepted that, and there is an oral argument scheduled there, which will also be recorded. I don't recall the exact date, but it's in May at some point.
Okay. So very check back in June for the YouTube
I'm fully
oral argument.
Now.
I love
that.
If
you care about adverse possession or super gung-ho about real property rights.
Listen, I care. This podcast is making me care. I'm curious, though, too, aside from the biggest issue ever of adverse possession, what is a major legal issue or trend that you think is going to dominate the field over the next decade or so?
Yeah, so I do think an interesting issue that kind of has yet to be fully fleshed out is the artificial intelligence, AI. You know, I have seen, and I get those emails where attorneys are certifying that, you know, anytime an attorney files something, they're certifying the accuracy of that document. And I've seen stories where attorneys have used, you know, ChatGPT, right, to write a brief, and it's making up cases that don't exist.
Ah, yes.
And so then when an attorney files and uses these cases that are made up, they get in trouble because they don't exist. They didn't actually, you know, double check and use any of the legal search engines to verify that those existed.
Right. Cassidy v. Runnels, 1942.
And so, but I mean, it can be useful because, and some of the search engines have come out with an AI component, and you can be more literal and structured with how you do research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, find me a case that says this. Find me this law. You know, whatever your question is, and that kind of raises an interesting issue because with private practice, especially, we, you know, live and die and breathe by the billable hour. If it's taking us like a fraction of the time to find these answers and do this research, how does that affect, you know, because we're not going to be billing then as much. And I have a quota that I have to meet at the end of the year.
Right.
So that definitely, you know, it's like, how do you adjust for that? Do you bill for a flat fee then? How do you manage that? And how do you, I guess, just adapt with AI and the efficiency aspect with billing.
Well, and it is interesting the way that it varies on profession, right? Because, I mean, it could be a helpful research tool for a lawyer, whereas, you know, if I'm getting paid to write an article for a magazine and I completely have AI write it, then I'm getting paid unjustly for work I didn't do. So it just kind of depends on the profession, I think. I mean, mm-hmm. environmental effects aside, I think it's important to, you know, realize that some cases it could be useful, whereas others it could be counted as plagiarism or unethical in some way. So I'm always fascinated, especially since the entire premise of your profession is about ethics. I think it's very interesting to kind of bring in something that has been such a huge ethical debate of late.
And that is a good point, because if clients found out that we were using AI to find answers to research mm-hmm. questions on their cases, they'd probably, you know, question what they're paying for, because right. they might feel that they could do the same thing themselves. I don't recall the exact name of the application or the website, but we did test drive an AI, you know, database. It might have been one through Case Text or something else. I didn't really find it was particularly helpful. Maybe it'll get better, maybe it won't. I still do my own research, so clients are still paying me for work that I'm actually doing. So.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of seems to be the consensus right now at this stage in the game with AI. It's like, okay, it could help us maybe one day, but right now, not so much.
Well, and what about that poor little law intern who just wants to do research to get some experience, huh? They need something to do too. They can just replace AI for the law offices.
Well, maybe the interns run the AI.
Dun, dun, dun.
So I'm curious, too, if there are any historic cases that you wish you could have been a part of.
I think, really, any of the civil rights cases.
Yeah.
You know, Brown versus Board of Education is one that, you know, kind of sticks out in my mind. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely plenty of others, too, and I can't recall all of them by name off the top of my head. It's been a few years since I was in law school. But I think something where you are truly affecting, like, monumental change in society and in the country.
Yeah.
Definitely... Obergefell v. Hodges as well, which legalized same-sex marriage, mm-hmm. Actually originated in Ohio.
Which True is, that.
Yeah. So something like that. And for something that I personally believe in, too, mm-hmm. Obviously both, you know, civil rights and rights for African Americans and rights for the LGBTQIA plus community, that would definitely be something that would be huge to be a part of.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that. I would imagine that it's an interesting navigation point for you going back and forth between taking on certain cases versus, you know, maintaining some of your ethics, right? And I would imagine you might not have to deal with that as much being in like business litigation or property litigation, but I think it is definitely a question that most lawyers have to grapple with at some point in terms of their ethics versus caseload, right?
Yeah. Thankfully, it's not really a huge issue for me right now at this point in time in my career. I definitely felt, you know, when I was interning with a public defender, it felt very like part of the system. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can talk for so long about reform on the prison system and the criminal law system. I mean, you know, I won't go on into huge details about my thoughts there, but it just felt weird because it just felt like we were pushing cases through. And I mean, they're overburdened, the public defender. They have so much because, unfortunately, when people get arrested, if they had a job, they lost their job. So they're just overburdened, overworked, but they're doing such good work. But at the same time, it's just a tough environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, on ending on a little bit of a lighter note, I do want to ask, obviously, throughout all points in your life, you've been involved in some sort of extracurricular, even if you don't think that you are that involved. But you're very involved in the Toledo community. So I'm wondering, outside of Eastman and Smith, how you're involved in our community.
Yeah, I'm involved in, obviously, the legal community through the Toledo Bar Association. And even my work, we do some volunteering events, you know, on Martin Luther King Day. I did a day of service with the United Way most recently. Within the community outside of the legal community, I'm pretty involved now with Epic Toledo, which is like a young professionals networking association. It's pretty great to be able to meet new young professionals and kind of expand my network. And it's been a lot of fun so far. The only thing I don't like is a 7:30 a.m. meeting, but you know, I'm learning to listen to my alarm.
Don't look at me like that. I'm sorry.
I wasn't looking. I don't know what's going on.
Listen, listen, it's
pleading
not
my, the fifth.
It's not my fault that the advisory council all have full-time jobs. And I, if it makes you feel better, don't like waking up early either. So we can be on the same page.
There you go.
But I know, I think it's really great that not only are you involved outside of Eastman and Smith, but also that you guys have a lot of volunteer opportunities within the firm too. I think that's a really impactful way to be involved.
Yeah. And then to kind of finish off this section before we get to the lovely Roman Empire, share with us your advice for young professionals who maybe want to go into law or just in general.
I think it's really, so I had a very open mind going into the legal field. I don't have any family who are lawyers. This was an idea that I invented on my own, for better or for worse. So if you can find somebody that's already in the legal community, and typically it won't be a big deal to, you know, shadow or attend a deposition, go to see a trial. I mean, the courts are open, public buildings, so anybody can walk in at any time. I mean, obviously when it's open. and, you know, watch whatever's going on. I think that's the best way to kind of see, is this something that I may or may not see myself doing? Because as I said, you know, I was really into Boston Legal. You know, I feel like that's kind of an obscure pick. You know, most people are saying, oh, Law and Order, or I loved Legally Blonde.
What, you're not a fan of Legally Blonde?
I didn't say I didn't like it. That's more of a law school movie than more of like a practicing.
Fair.
Gotcha.
So if you want like a practicing movie, My Cousin Vinny is my favorite, probably.
Truth.
It's
truth.
So good.
Amen. No better witness than Marissa Tomei, let me tell you what.
I could talk forever. That was a great scene. Getting back to the real world, finding somebody who's already in the community will expose yourself to actually be able to determine whether or not you could see yourself in that field.
Yeah.
And I think that's important.
A good mentor.
Definitely. We love mentorship here. And you didn't think we were going to end the episode without a Roman Empire.
Absolutely not.
So, Libby, you want to kick us off today?
Yeah, I am simply thinking about Lady Gaga on Hot Ones, and not even anything that happens in the episode or any of the ways that she answered the questions, just simply the look.
The hair, real.
The makeup, the outfit, just to go eat some wings. It's so extravagant. And, of course, like, we would expect that from Gaga every time.
Not that she ever went anywhere, but she has been on her comeback game lately with Abracadabra and all of that. I feel like the old Gaga's coming back.
I know. I just love her so much. And she looks so just gorgeous and ethereal. And I just love her so bad. And
true.
That's my Roman Empire forever, I think.
As it should. You had me at Lady Gaga. All right, Nick, what do you have for us today?
My Roman Empire is the Ottoman Empire. No, I'm kidding. kind of actually not going off too far from Lady Gaga. I think about RuPaul's Drag Race a lot lately.
Yeah.
There you go.
Lately? You mean forever always?
Well, not forever always. I actually didn't really get into it until I started seeing my girlfriend currently, and she kind of got me to watch it. And it is honestly one of the best pieces of television that's
truly
out there.
Yeah.
And RuPaul, the queen, is out there basically being a therapist too. Like,
yeah,
she's sitting there and
working overtime,
deep diving on emotional, like, everybody's being so emotionally vulnerable. I'm like, wow, like, there's a ton of people that could benefit. Like, I think Rue might be like a licensed therapist or deserves to have some sort of licensure at this point.
I agree, right?
And I mean, they're all so talented.
The artistry is insane. Yeah,
it is insane. It is great. I actually, you know, it's kind of funny. There's an affinity group at the University of Toledo, the law school. It's called Outlaw, and they advocate for LGBTQI+ rights. And I don't recall how many years they've done it, but they do a drag show. And I actually participated last year.
No way.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
No,
I have
pictures.
Is this on YouTube too?
Yeah, we need photo
it's
evidence.
It's not on YouTube, but I have pictures. I'll show them to you.
Iconic.
I love it.
Iconic. See, y'all will just have to come to a community event to meet Nick so that you can also see some photos of the iconic drag look.
What's yours?
Mine is kind of deviating a little bit into a more wholesome category, but still on the celebrity culture train. I just read Kelly Bishop's autobiography called The Third Gilmore Girl, which anyone who knows me knows I love Gilmore Girls. But Kelly Bishop actually started not on television, but on Broadway and mm-hmm. as a dancer. So I'm in my free time a choreographer and dancer. And so reading the first half of that book, which was all about her coming up in her mid-20s as a dancer, her experience learning classical ballet as a child and moving across the country to follow her ballet instructors. And then, you know, the start of a chorus line, which I think is so incredible. I mean, her character in that show, they wrote based on her actual life and yeah. her life story, which it came from a workshop where all of the actors were talking about how they got into dancing. And then seriously, the character she ended up playing was based on her own life, which I find so crazy, because that is such a popular show. And also the weird fun fact of they called it a chorus line instead of chorus line so that it would show up first in the bill of what was going on Broadway, which I think is so brilliant. Yeah. They're so smart for that. But also, you know, the insight of her life in Gilmore Girls and her other television projects. A lot of people forget that she was the mom on Dirty Dancing, which is wild, which she actually was supposed to play a different part, but then ended up getting the mom. So there's a lot of really cool behind the scenes if you're a Broadway fan and a television fan, mm-hmm. or, you know, if you just like Kelly Bishop, whose original name was Carol Bishop, and she changed it to Kelly. Listen, I learned so much about this woman. I sat down and I read this book in the span of 5 hours. I did not put it down. I did not look away. It was
incredible.
And now
you know everything about her.
Now I know everything about her. Quiz me. Quiz me on Kelly Bishop. I'm ready.
Can't wait for the Kelly Bishop trivia at
yeah, literally.
The local bar.
I was about to say, I'm running it. $5 entry. Come hang out. So, yeah, but I loved it. And I would highly recommend. I'm a big autobiography girly, but this one definitely never slows down. It's really interesting.
I love that. Yeah. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me share. I'm actually the guest today. No, Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes,
we're so
you.
Happy to learn about your career and more about you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
We want to thank Nick Bartlett, our guest on today's show. We're your hosts and producers, Libby and Riley, and our executive producer is the incomparable Chris Pfeiffer.
If you have any questions, comments, or you just want to listen again, go to wgte.org/comeup or wherever you stream your podcast.
Bye, besties!
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.